Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see? Pick up the mirror now, America. Go ahead, pick it up. What are you, afraid? It's just a mirror, America. What could it do to you except reflect your image? The Majority Report.
It is Wednesday, January 5th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow. I should say within the literal, not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's 2 days in a row I've got it right, folks. 2011.
I saw a little smile on your face when you got it.
I was very excited that I nailed it. I knew exactly what year this was. I've yet to have that thing where you write 2010 on a check. Fortunately, because I got no money to write any checks with. It's keeping me from misdating my checks, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. We have a great show for you today. Digby from the blog Hullabaloo will be on. That you can find that at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Dorsey has just run in, so I guess we can get ready now. This story, you know, I don't know what to say about this. I am going to try not to be too much of a dick about it. I'm going to try not to be heartless, no pun intended. A few days before, back in July, if you've seen pictures of Dick Cheney, you will notice that he looks rather gaunt, a little bit thin. And he has just recently escaped, I don't know if he's escaped prosecution, but wasn't it Nigeria that had charged him in absentia for some bribery charges involving the company he used to run called Halliburton. And my understanding is that James Baker, Poppy Bush's, I guess, Secretary of State, smoothed things out. Without slagging Nigeria, my guess would be that involves a suitcase and some cash. So Dick Cheney received in July a heart pump that apparently saved his life. And it helps to push blood through his arteries. I'm not sure why this piece is coming out in the New York Times. I guess it's just sort of he's back on the scene. Maybe it's some pre-book. He's got a book that's coming out soon. The family members and friends paint a portrait of a man less focused on the day-to-day back and forth in Washington and one more interested in documenting his years of service in a memoir and navigating his life with his new pump. You know, folks, Dick Cheney is nearing the end of his life. Maybe he's got a couple more years. I would imagine there's a lot more importance in trying to rewrite history so that he is not considered the sole leader of an administration that lied the American public into a war which cost the lives of at least 100,000 innocent civilians and 4,000 or 5,000 U.S. military personnel and, of course, trillions of dollars which remain unpaid for, and will come out of people's Social Security. But here's the interesting part. Mr. Cheney's heart will never beat at full strength again. His new mechanical pump, a partial artificial heart known as a ventricular assist device, leaves patients without a pulse. The man has no pulse. Now, I'll tell you what I want to see. I want to see this man's birth certificate. How do we know he was ever even born? How do we know he wasn't just some robot constructed by Karl Rove? Where are the birthers on this? We have a former vice president without a pulse. Has anybody in this room seen his birth certificate? Have you seen it, Dorsey?
Never.
No. What about you, Evan?
I've never seen it.
Can you even tell me what state he was born in?
Wyoming.
Was it Wyoming?
I don't know. He was
coming. Right, right. We're all led to believe he was born in some state. My guess is he was probably built in the garage of some evil scientist. Most pulseless patients feel nothing unusual. I would imagine that Dick Cheney does not recognize the lack of a pulse. Frankly, I would imagine he could take his heart out and he wouldn't know it. I'm sorry. I know that I should have it in my actual beating heart. I think you can hear my pulse. I know I should have it in my actual heart to have more sympathy for this war criminal, serial liar, and psychopath, but I don't. I wish him a healthy and happy life of playing golf and riding bikes, as it's said that he can, and his 20th anniversary flight to Texas to celebrate the Persian Gulf War, attached with a vest with 12-volt batteries to keep his artificial heart or near-artificial heart beating. Good luck with that. Good luck with that. I wonder how he created his daughter. Can Cylons do that? But Cylons actually have a pulse. Yeah. He's not even a Cylon. Enjoy. Wow. So, it does not come as a shock to me.
That's why.
And by shock, I don't, and no pun intended. Is there even a story here?
Not really.
You'll recall the other day, maybe it was yesterday, maybe it was, I think, last week, Wednesday, I reported that the death panels, yes, the death panels. And by death panels, of course, what we mean is that Medicare will actually pick up the tab for end-of-the-life consultations with doctors, which will save lives, which will save money, which will help people whose loved ones are incapacitated. I think there is complete and universal agreement by everyone in the medical profession, everyone in the social work profession, everyone in the health insurance profession, I think probably every profession, short of the professional liars on the right, that end-of-life counseling is incredibly helpful for everyone involved, and the idea that Medicare would pay for it is a great thing because it needs to be encouraged and it needs to be raised by doctors to remind people that, hey, if you don't have a living will, you need one. That's what it is. It's basically a living will. And so it was reinstated into health care reform via regulation, which, of course, it can be. The idea that Medicare will choose different procedures that it will pay, it's not a legislative decision anyways. But, of course, Fox News responds in typical fashion within just days of somebody noticing that it is now a regulation that could be picked up by Medicare on January 1.
Are the so-called death panels revived? If you thought the death panel debate was dead, think again. It's heating up.
Clever.
And you have to stick around to find out what's in store for end-of-life planning starting this Saturday.
The elderly and senior citizens watching this show right now better know that doctors are going to get reimbursed for pushing you into hospice and pushing you into no treatment for serious conditions. That is going to be a fact as we move down the road. I hope people understand that.
You know what, Grandma? It's going to cost the government too much money to keep you alive. So here are your alternatives.
And it's with Obamacare that people are going to die based on who the government thinks ought to die.
In other words, the government will now pay doctors to counsel patients to opt out of medical treatment that might prolong their lives.
And the more government takes over health care, the more government rationing there'll be. And the more the government will tell you whether you have to have a living will or whether you have to discuss it with your doctor every year or every 5 years.
Donald Berwick, you remember him. He's an open proponent of the British style of universal health care with rationing of medical services decreed by bureaucrats. He's the socialist who wants to decide who lives and who dies. He announced that he had created the death panels pursuant to authority in the new law.
These end-of-life counseling sessions appear to be less voluntary than the administration would say, and the government appears to be trying to script what is actually said in these counseling sessions rather than letting your doctor decide.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I don't think in that minute 43 compilation there was a single not lie. And it would be incredibly amusing to hear about death panels and how doctors are incentivized to give you less treatment. Of course, they'd get paid more if they gave you more treatment. It's quite possible that an end-of-the-life counseling would require more treatment. It would be hilarious to listen to that compilation of Fox idiots. Were it not for the fact that Robert Parr in the New York Times reports today that the Obama administration will revise a Medicare regulation to delete references to end-of-life planning as part of the annual physical examinations covered under the new health care law. They have reversed themselves. Was anybody even discussing this outside of the tiny universe of morons and idiots in Fox News? You know, what we're going to need is some type of color coding system. When the Obama administration actually capitulates, we could put we could color code it like a sky blue, like a filing system. And when the Obama administration appears to capitulate, but actually is really carrying out their agenda, their neoliberal agenda, like cutting Social Security, we could put a red or maybe like a heather yellow or something like that label on it. This would be the sky blue. This is just sad capitulation. We will amend the regulation to take out the voluntary advanced care planning. The official said this should not affect beneficiaries' ability to have these voluntary conversations with the doctors. Of course it won't, except for they'll still be able to have the conversations, but they just won't be able to get reimbursed for it. It'll cost them money. So it's basically just a disincentive to have something that every single person who works within the healthcare field on every aspect of it thinks is a good thing. And I would remind you that these ideas of these consultations, not panels, just one doctor, they can't even get that part, is not a lie, was promoted by Senator Johnny Isaacson from Georgia, Republican. And then three Republican co-sponsors in the House with Earl Blumenhauer, the Democrat from Oregon. So congratulations. The terrorists on the right have been rewarded again. And now we will take a break. We will be back in just a moment with the blogger Digby, who will be discussing with us the Republicans' plans for the new congressional session, which starts today. At this very moment, John Bonner could be crying over a Bible.
I never thought I'd have a chance to...
We'll be right back. right, folks. We are dealing with just a little bit of technical difficulties. And maybe we will connect with Digby shortly. Maybe we won't. This is a great time to suggest that you become a member of the Majority Report at majority.fm. Your membership will enhance our ability to make a phone call and to have guests on. You know, you'd be shocked on how complicated it can be when you're trying to get a certain level of quality and then also on the cheap.
It's true.
Both are, you know, economists can tell you that's a very difficult intersection to navigate. The Fed, and I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, and I guess it was revived, is pushing new mortgage regulation. They tried this. I mean, I remember this story. They tried it one way, and now they seem to be trying it another one. A new mortgage regulation that would essentially eliminate and gut the federal remedy and, I guess, the federal punishment or disincentive for predatory lending. The regulation would severely limit a practice called rescission, which is used to strike down demonstrably illegal or fraudulent loan contracts and void a bank's ill-gotten gains. In other words, if you can prove that your loan was entered into under duress or fraud, that the bank, you know, slipped some papers in there and made you sign it or didn't fully disclose what they are legally obliged to disclose to you in terms of interest rates, in terms of the way that they would jump up, whatever it was, the remedy that the court, in the course of a foreclosure proceedings, the remedy that a judge would provide for would be to basically say you are still responsible for the principal that you borrowed. We were going to set up a payment plan in which you pay off that principal, but the foreclosure cannot go forward. You cannot lose the home and the money that you may have already sunk into the home, for that matter. The Fed wants to switch that. That in the event that you have been defrauded, essentially, in the course of getting a loan, the Fed wants you to be obligated to pay off the principal before the bank loses its right to foreclose. So, in other words, you're going into foreclosure proceedings because you're having trouble making ends meet. You can't pay the principal plus interest payments that you are obligated to pay on a monthly basis. You go into bank and you say, look, you go into court and you say, look, this bank defrauded me. I didn't realize the interest rates were going to go up so high. I didn't realize I had signed that paper. They defrauded me. You must prove to a court that they defrauded you. So this isn't a question of like, I was a speculator, I got in too deep, whatever it was. You must prove that they've defrauded you. Once they've defrauded you at that point, what usually happens, like I said, is that they determine, okay, loan is invalid, you still owe the principal, but you cannot lose your house at this point. The court will order you to repay the principal on a certain schedule, and now the Fed wants to take that away. I mean, it's just shocking. At a time when you have all these foreclosures, when you have our economy in such deep trouble, what the Fed is basically saying is like, look, we really need to help out the banks. All we care about is the banks. Even if they have committed fraud, we still need to give them the ability to put you out on the street. It's stunning. It's stunning. I'm sure we'll hear all those tea parties who think the Fed is, run by the Rothschilds and interterrestrials coming out of Mount Shasta. I'm sure we will hear from them on this. No, wait a second. I'm sorry. I'm sure we won't. That's what I meant to say. I'm sure we won't. Meanwhile, we had mentioned in the defense authorization bill, Democrats had put in a provision where no funding would be provided to allow for the military to transport any prisoners from Guantanamo anywhere in the U.S. for trial. So in other words, effectively shutting down the idea of civilian trials in the United States for our prisoners. And as this law hits the president's desk to sign as part of the larger defense authorization bill, the president has an opportunity to include a signing statement. Now, the signing statements have always existed. They were completely abused by the Bush administration. They are supposed to allow the president an opportunity to sign a bill, but say, like, I have problems with this or that constitutionally, or I still reserve the right to do this or that. George Bush really abused the process, and Charlie Savage, who writes this piece, wrote a whole book on it. His aides, President Obama's, are likely to recommend that Obama sharply criticize the limitations when he signs the limitation, the legislation, but not that he asserts that he has the constitutional authority to lawfully bypass the federal statutes containing such limits. So in other words, he'll say, I don't agree with this that much, but I'm not going to assert that I have the constitutional authority to determine where these prisoners are tried. This is, for our color coding purposes, this would be a sky blue. This would be another cave-in. Ridiculous. This is a hot potato. He doesn't want to hold it. And this is the only time that I think he's relinquished any presidential executive authority. This is probably the most, the one time he has denied himself the authority that George Bush would have taken for himself. And, of course, it's the one time where he could do something proper with it. And it's probably the one time where most constitutional authorities would say, oh, no, he clearly
can do that.
And this is a little bit micromanaging on the part of Congress. But that's what it is. Bumblebees in U.S. are suffering a sharp decline, joining countless other species disappearing worldwide. Huffington Post reports yesterday, North American bees are... Now, they supposedly solved it, but it doesn't sound like they've solved this riddle. North American bees are disappearing at a rapid rate, signaling a dire threat to the production of countless food sources. The Guardian reports that four common species of U.S. bumblebees have declined, you ready for this? 96% in recent decades. And scientists are speculating that disease and inbreeding are responsible. Honeybees have long been known to be in decline, suffering from colony collapse disorder, which nobody can quite figure out is a function of.
You know, upstate in my parents' farmhouse, we bought the farmhouse. There were bees that lived in the walls, and we were told, you know, contact like this guy or this guy associated with this university. They'll come and get the bees.
Right.
Because there are so few bees that they need to be collected and taken care of.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, as I'm sure you know, without bees, we have trouble pollinating most plants and vegetables and fruits. They pollinate 90% of the world's commercial plants, from fruits and vegetables to coffee and cotton. And while a correlation between the Nosema bombi fungus infection and the declining bumblebee population was discovered, culprit isn't clearly defined. And then, of course, tigers can be extinct in 12 years. Oh, you liberal whiny babies! Boo-hoo, there won't be any bees. file that in the global warming's a good thing, too, because then we won't have to wear winter coats. Maybe that can be a new job for humans. Once we have shipped all our manufacturing jobs overseas, we can just have people who are born as pollinators. We can get Monsanto to genetically redesign human beings so that they have very, very long, narrow lips protruding from their face.
And no hearts.
So that's exactly.
And they can live forever into it.
Exactly. There you go. Let's do our... let's get this story, because this is a happy story. You know how Glenn Beck is a huge multimillionaire? And New York City is the... I think it's the officially the number two radio market in the country, L.A. being the number one. Seems Glenn Beck is going to lose his job on WOR. That's not necessary. Four, three, six, six. I hope you're not applauding me. All right. I wasn't responsible for it. WOR getting rid of the Glenn Beck program in the mid-mornings, 9 to noon, my old time slot. I missed that time slot. And they brought in Mike Gallagher, some semi-right-wing hack who just gets outraged about everything, who's probably still talking about how it was some guy was asleep in his truck, probably, snow plowing. But, you know, apparently he's in trouble. He's losing WOR. He's losing a Philadelphia affiliate. And his Boston station, they call it Rush Radio. Now, let me tell you something, folks. The idea that right-wing talkers could lose affiliates, particularly this size, is stunning. Listen to Glenn Beck's show. Well, don't. Just take my word for it. Do yourself a favor. The entire thing is an advertisement for the Heritage Foundation and for Americans for Prosperity, based upon his advocacy of them. Now, think about this for a moment. He's being almost directly funded by the Koch brothers. Fine. Which means that he can subsidize the cost of his program to a place like WOR. In other words, his show probably doesn't cost WOR very much at all. His show probably it's just a barter system. You know, we take some of the net, we take most of the ad inventory. You get some of the local ad inventory. His ratings must be so low at WOR as to be stunning. The WOR would actually pay to bring somebody in and get more value out of their commercial time. The advantage, and do you know how much funding, Dorsey, you must remember this. Do you know how much funding we got from like places like Center for American Progress, which I guess is an equivalent, or I don't know, Soros, or.
We got some books, I think.
Yeah, no, we definitely got books.
Got books. Money, not so sure.
Money, we got none. Yeah, we got none. And I don't even think they bought advertisement, you know? I mean, if you listen to Limbaugh or Hannity, it's, you know, every 5 minutes, it's the Heritage Foundation in some, like, homage to Ronnie Reagan. I'm not kidding. Heritage Foundation pays for... What is the Heritage... It's a huge money laundering outfit. That's all. And, they certainly are, God bless them. I think it's great. I would love to see it on the left. But I tell you this because of the canard that left-wing radio, which just wasn't popular enough. Are you going to hear any of those people talk about that the Rush radio in Boston is... And this is where Scott Brown got elected. Right? That Rush Radio is doing so crappily. That Beck is doing so crappily. Philadelphia, crappy. So there you have it. Let's move on to the my long-awaited... wait a second. Maybe. Oh, there we go. We'll be right back, folks. Let's take a break. We are back, and ladies and gentlemen, through the wonders of technology, which we still could use, Majority Report members to enhance. But be that as it may, on the phone-ish, on a telecommunications device, from the blog Hullabaloo is Digby. Welcome to the program, Digby.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Sorry I'm late. It's a little earlier out here on the West Coast. So.
I understand, believe me.
Not firing on all cylinders quite yet, but I think I can communicate fairly well.
If I can't tell you how many times I've said 80% of Digby is worth 120% of just about any other blogger.
Well, thank you very much. I think.
I meant that in the best of ways, of course.
I assume so. Yes, thank you.
Now let me get my. Now where did my list of questions for Digby go? Oh, here it is. Okay, so I wanted to talk to you today. Of course, is maybe as we speak, John Bonaire is somewhere, crying, sniveling into a handkerchief, talking about what a wonderful opportunity it's going to be for him to help further the corporate agenda of our elite corporations and wealthy people in this country. What an honor it is for him to do so, and partnered with such people as Daryl Issa, didn't Daryl Issa, you would know this because he's from California, wasn't he famous for turning back odometers on cars?
He was, and car theft, and he also was responsible for one of the most destructive inventions ever known to man, at least to my own peace of mind, which is the car alarm that says "step away from the car," and it's his voice, by the way, that's on that recording. And here in California, of course, it's ubiquitous, and it's a total nightmare. I can't believe he hasn't been run out of office for that reason alone.
I had no idea.
Yes.
Well, I mean, at least he's showing some entrepreneurial spirit. I think that's important. I mean, maybe he can I don't know why we don't hear more of that. As people start to say, he's going to turn back the deficit just like he did with cars.
That's all it takes. Break into the treasury, steal the money, and lo and behold,
So let's talk about a couple of sort of disturbing things that we might expect on the horizon, and I want to get to a couple of memes, but first let's talk about, you've been writing about the grand bargain that apparently the Obama administration and its advisors were very keen on as early as days before the inauguration in 2009. Tell us what the grand bargain supposedly is, and tell us what it seems to be shaping up to be.
Well, it was very explicit. This was happening. I don't know if you recall, there was a meeting where they brought in all the, what they now call the professional left, into the White House, or I guess it wasn't to the White House before the inauguration. And I remember that E.J. Dionne in particular wrote a big story about it, and it was, I don't know, it was in early January, in which Obama laid out his plan to enact a grand bargain with the Republicans. And it was, you know, capital G, capital B. I mean, we're talking grand bargain where everyone was going to have, quote, skin in the game, and we were going to solve all of America's problems going forward for, I don't know, the next 100 years. It was a huge issue, where a huge negotiation where they were going to lay it all out on the table.
I love the idea that we're going to solve all the problems. And you know what? I'm willing to wait. If it takes three meetings to do it, let's do it.
Hey, you know, I'm not going to wait that long. I'm sorry. I two meetings max, and I want it done. That's, you know, this is what we hire these people for. And it was interesting because it was in the middle of, you know, the economic meltdown of the century. We were still reeling from what had happened, and nobody, and, you know, at the time they were talking about having to put through what we thought was going to be, you know, $1 trillion stimulus. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it struck me at the time as being what the hell? You know, this was like, it was so hubristic, so arrogant, so, you know, absurd. First of all, the idea that the Republicans were going to sit down and bargain in good faith struck me as being delusional. But even beyond that, the idea that they were, that there was this huge idea of being able to solve once and for all everything, which is essentially what it was. I mean, this was like, you know, we're going to put education on the table. We're going to talk about, you know, so we're going to fix the, quote, entitlements, which automatically my alarm bells went off. And I went, uh-oh, mm-hmm. We've got a problem. In any case, this was out there. And, you know, you'll recall in the early days they had these summits, right? They had the fiscal responsibility summit. They had the healthcare summit. They were bringing in people from all over the land, and they were going to just sit down and hash it out and fix it. And the Fiscal Responsibility Summit was the first place where I realized they were really serious about the Social Security thing. And they were going to bring in people, bad people, like Pete Peterson was going to be a keynote speaker. And
tell us who Pete Peterson is, because his name gets bandied about quite a bit.
Pete Peterson is a billionaire, you know, Wall Street mogul who multi-billionaire, I should say, who has devoted the last 30 years of his life to the destruction of Social Security. He calls himself a deficit hawk, but it's obvious that that really isn't the issue. No matter what, you know, we had a time, for instance, in 2000 when we had a big budget surplus, and he wasn't there saying, huzzah, you know, we fixed it, let's move on to the next problem. He was still cranky and saying, well, we should, you know, use that for some other purpose. He's always... His view is, and I think it was expressed probably most, revealingly when he said back in 1994 that, this country can't afford to let people spend the last third of their lives on a publicly paid vacation. So I think that's pretty clear how
he sees. I mean, he is one of these guys who just believes, from an ideological, level that this country turned socialist in 1938 or 37, whenever Social Security 36 came in.
Right. Right. He's the Andrew Mellon, you know, those guys. I mean, just basically he's one of those, you know, he's what we used, he's a plutocrat, basically. Right. And he's devoted a great deal of time and money to this. Most recently, within the last decade or so, he created the Peterson Institute, which he devoted $1 billion to, which is specifically designed to reduce entitlements. Again, they call it deficit reduction. We know that's not true. They pretend to be in favor of, you know, tax cuts, tax hikes, but whenever they actually come up, they're always the wrong ones. So we know that this is what he's about. In any case, the Obama administration had invited him to be a keynote speaker, and word got around, and there was enough of an outcry among the, quote, professional left that they decided that it wasn't good timing to do Social Security, especially with, you know, we were in the midst of an economic catastrophe, and a lot of people were feeling a little bit insecure, so maybe putting Social Security and pensions on the table wasn't the smartest thing to do at that moment. So they pulled back a little bit, but it did come up, and there were, you know, comments made, one in particular by Gene Sperling, who is under consideration to take Larry Summers' place as the National Economic Advisor in the White House, who said, you know, we think it'd be great to do, to be able to fix Social Security for, you know, for as far as the eye can see. People will thank us for that. So, you know, they had this in their heads from the very beginning.
Now, we should say there's two points here. One is Gene Sperling is supposedly the liberal that could be hired. But the other is that the idea of fixing Social Security, as far as the eye can see, I mean, first of all, if you don't think Social Security is fixed right now, then your eyes are like bionic man eyes. Because you're seeing further than 27, 28 years into the future. And even then, it's even debatable whether or not there's even any problem with Social Security at that point. But the idea that even if you were to fix Social Security for 75 years, there's nothing to stop the powers that be from putting Social Security in the exact same position as it is in now in 10 years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, they're not going to give this up. The whole idea is to end Social Security. I mean, they just simply have an ideological and philosophical belief that it's wrong, that it's socialistic, that, you know, that we shouldn't do it. And therefore, I mean, I think they truly believe that, I don't know, the elderly should go sell pencils on the corner, get charity, or be rich. I mean, that's about it. And so, you know, this isn't going to end with whatever it is that they come up with. And of course, you know, and it's a battle that they like to have. I mean, one of the things that the right it understands is that the battle is part of, you know, their reason for being. So they continue these battles because it justifies their existence, right? So you can't solve problems when you think about that. You want to keep the fight going anyway. And in this case, it's completely unnecessary. I mean, look, we've got a lot of problems in this country. Social Security doesn't happen to be one of them. It's just not there. I mean, yes, somewhere down the road, there's going to have to be an adjustment made. It's a very simple one. You raise the cap on the payroll tax so that people who are, you know, make a lot of money pay more into it. Simple. This isn't, you know, whatever happens, and it can happen down the road. We just do not have to think about this right now. It's not contributing to the deficit. That's one of the big myths about this whole thing, is that Social Security is somehow responsible for the deficit. It's not even part of the deficit. They don't count it. It's not even in there. The Social Security system's been in surplus for years, mostly because baby boomers, like me, have been paying in double our whole lives, not double, but substantially more, allegedly in preparation for our own retirement.
Right. This was the Greenspan Commission under the Reagan administration, which basically saw the demographic bump. You know, that's the thing that always sort of shocks me, how many people sort of like make a big deal about, but baby boomers are retiring. 10,000 baby boomers are retiring every 30 seconds. Well, you know, I got news for you. There's a reason they called them baby boomers.
Right.
Like, they knew there was a lot of babies, and if you could add 0 plus 65, you could figure out when they were all going to retire. So this wasn't like this is some type of alchemy here that you need
it's
to be
like everybody just woke up and noticed.
Right,
CNN,
my God.
They did this.
It never occurred to me why we called them baby boomers.
Yeah. On New Year's, they did this on CNN. They had a segment. We go, oh, my God, look what's happening.
Well, to be honest with you, when I was filling in for Olbermann, in the morning meeting, they have a morning meeting where we talk about the stories, and somebody says, you know, there are 10,000 baby boomers, and what's this going to mean for Social Security? Well, this question was asked literally 27 years ago in 1983. And they came up with an answer, and so nothing. It's not going to change anything. It's
exactly.
Not like all of a sudden people realized on 2010, on I just realized all these people are turning 65. all right, but let's move on from that. So we're on the grand bargain here.
Right.
What theoretically are we going to – so we're going to cut Social Security. What are we going to get? I mean, what's the bargain?
Well, that's the question. I mean, you know, I think just to just go back, just in recap, just a little bit. I think what Obama has been wanting from the beginning was to have a legacy of having solved these great problems.
Right.
You know, healthcare, Social Security, solvency through the end of time, whatever else. You know. Whatever else they you know had on their agenda, these big huge intractable problems that were going to require bipartisan cooperation. So they had that in their heads, and I think that they still see that as being, I mean, I'm guessing that they still see this as being what they want to do because they're doing it. So, you know, there you go. So it, when we look at what we're doing now, they're probably going to come in, I think, with the recommendations of the president's own deficit commission, which, by the way, put Social Security on the menu, and it wasn't even on the mandate for the commission.
Right.
They weren't supposed to look at Social Security, but they said, you know what? We've got a little extra time here. Why don't we fix that problem? So we'll do that too. And so they actually put that on their in their report, and they had no business doing it, but they did.
Well, we
and
should add. We should add that first of all, it's not even a real report. By their by their own rules, they were supposed to have 14 out of 18 people validate any report. It's not even a report. It's just a couple of guys who got together in a room at this point.
Exactly. They couldn't get the votes they needed to turn out a real report. They should have just said, "Hey, we couldn't agree." And that's that. But instead, they did an end run, put out the report of the two deficit hawks that were put in charge of it, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, both of whom were adamant about you know, quote, deficit reduction. They weren't didn't exactly go into it with an open mind. And in the end, they put out this quote preliminary report that is now being used as the basis for a group of, you know, centrist senators to come in. We're going to start working with that. So that's what they're working on as sort of a framework, I think. And my as I'm watching what's happening unfold with the Republicans coming in, Lindsey Graham signaled on the weekend that he would not consider raising the debt ceiling until we dealt with entitlements. And I'm assuming that's kind of a, you know, that's a shot across the bow that that's going to be one of the hostages in this negotiation,
right,
is the debt ceiling. You know, there are other things that are out there. I mean, this negotiation, which will undoubtedly take place among players in the White House and Republicans. It appears to me that that's the way this negotiation is going to go. I mean, there may be people in the Senate who are sort of operating around the edges on this deficit commission concept. But it sounds to me like they're planning to do something fairly, you know, grand, if you want to coin out, you know,
but
use
the bargain is going to be, you cut Social Security, and we will not cause the government to go into default,
right,
and crash the stock market.
Exactly. And I think what they will give as a sweetener for the White House probably to use as a sop, they think, to the base, is that they're going to do what they call tax reform, which is basically they're going to, you know, do some you know, alchemy with the, you know, with the corporate tax, which they think is going to sound really good to us because, gosh, those liberals really hate corporations. So what we'll do is we'll say we're sticking it to the corporations, and we'll raise a bunch of money doing that, and we'll cut Social Security, and the Republicans will you know, agree not to crash the economy, and it will be considered a great big victory, just like the lame duck tax cut extension was, and everybody goes, "Isn't this terrific? We've got real leadership in Washington again." Now, the problem is, of course, the you know, tax reform will not be real tax reform. I mean, they have big, very, very fancy tax lawyers available to skirt any of those rules.
Right, of course.
The raising of the debt ceiling is normally a pro forma vote. You don't not even thought about. I mean, they can do it by acclamation. It's not even seriously used. But suddenly, because of the teabaggers, they've decided they're going to turn this into a bargaining chip. And so what happens? So, you know, what's the real thing accomplished in that? It's the entitlement cut. And it can't, I don't think it can be Medicare because that's already sort of encompassed in the healthcare reform. So we're talking about Social Security. And if you look at the Peterson, at the Freudian slip there, the Deficit Commission's recommendations, you can see the outlines of what the Social Security,
right, they're going to raise the retirement age, and they may do, yeah, some means testing on the higher end, which is a way to sort of like chip away and degrade the political underpinnings of the program. But let me ask you this. When we look at these players, like, you know, on one hand you have the P. Petersons who are ideologically opposed to Social Security. They hate the concept. I imagine so we could put him into one category. They hate the concept of this country becoming socialist, communistic, and they're convinced that it's been that way since basically the last 80 years because of Social Security. On another, sort of like another category of person who would hate Social Security is someone who knows that from a political, purely political perspective, it is the linchpin of Democratic politics. That Social Security is the, you know, is the one thing that Democrats own and is a third rail, theoretically. And then it seems to me you move into people like, you know, maybe Simpson and Bowles, the head of the people who are just basically out to say, like, okay, we're really wealthy. We've got this deficit problem. And that, is a problem maybe for some of our wealthy bondholder friends. Where can we get the money without having to raise taxes on rich people? We can steal it from Social Security. So it's not a question of, like, these people are not like Pete Peterson, who just think that, like, you know, there's something morally repugnant about old people not starving to death. They just sort of feel like, well, I don't care about old people who are not as rich as me. What I do care about is not having to raise taxes on on the rich. And so Social Security, we're basically stealing the money from Social Security to pay off the deficit, right? I mean, isn't that what it is?
Well,
they're basically saying, like, we have borrowed money from the Social Security Trust Fund. There's an easy way to sort of, like, deal with the deficit,
right.
And that's by basically stealing that money.
Yeah, we just won't pay it back, which is essentially what they're saying. I mean, they're saying that, you know, I mean,
and do you think Obama's caving? When we get to Obama, where is he on the spectrum? Because I don't see him as caving. I think he just believes sort of some combination of those categories.
Yeah, it's really hard for me. I never know. He's an enigma to me and always has been, is particularly about this kind of thing. But most people are. I mean, I don't honestly know what's in his heart. But from what I can gather, I mean, I see him over the last 2 years as being, he's a technocratic guy. He wants to be seen as a guy who solved problems. He went in there and, you know, brought people together and knocked some heads and got it done. You know, that's how I think. I don't think he has a particular ideology. At least there's nothing that I can see that indicates that. So my feeling is that he's somehow been convinced that this is a problem he can solve.
The deficit is the paramount ultimate problem.
By the way, Bill Clinton did solve that deficit problem, and I suspect there may even be some idea that, well, he needs to do that too, so that, you know, he can maintain, I don't know,
he can
maintain
be America's,
the Democratic
he can be America's
reputation.
First black president who was the America's first white president who was black.
Right, something. I mean, I don't even want to. this is beyond my ken to get into that.
Wasn't Clinton the first black president?
Yeah, exactly.
Obama could be the first black president who was the first white president who was black. I mean, because someone said to me recently, and someone who is from a very wealthy person who is from sort of the world in which the people around Obama emanate from. And I was saying, like, you know, what do you think it is about Obama? And he said, he believes these people. He believes the Robert Rubens. He believes the Larry Summers. He believes these people. And he believes that they have achieved what they've achieved based on merit. And it is because of where Obama came from that he views these people as actually having a legitimacy that their records would not suggest they should have. And this guy says, you know, I know this because I came from these people. These are the type of people who get C's in college and cheat at tennis. And this was a guy who definitely did grow up with these people. And he said Obama believes them. And I think that's, you know, it's relevant not just from a sort of historical psychological standpoint, but the best way to fight this. And maybe it's not about convincing Obama. Maybe it's just about providing some sheer political strength.
Well, you know, I mean, well, that's the question of the age, isn't it? I mean, how do you influence this situation? I don't know that we've had very much luck so far, although we may have had more than we realize just simply because we don't know what position they started from. So it's
right.
Possible that, you know, we ended up a lot better than we might have. where we just don't know it. I suspect, and I do think this is true. Again, you know, this is a guy who I consider to be like a technocrat, rather than a, you know, a philosopher, ideologue, or even a partisan. And I think that he does turn to those guys because they're the experts, right? I mean, this is the best and the brightest syndrome that we're reliving here, which is that these guys who may have even done some, you know, some good things back in the 90s under a completely different situation. And, you know, I'm not going to condemn them across the board. You know, whatever, they are what they are, but they are obviously at this point inadequate to the task at this point. I mean, we're just not seeing the results that need to happen for both on a, both a political and a policy level. Clearly their ideas aren't working. And yet what I think is happening is that, that, and this is another part of the Social Security grand bargain, is that they continue to believe that they need to send signals to markets. It's not just them. It's happening in Europe as well. I mean, you're finding all the central bankers, all the political leaders in Europe, they're all flailing around on this because I don't think these people really know what to do. And what they, what it appears to me is that they are captive of this, you know, last 20, 30 years of neoliberal economic thinking, which is that, you know, we need to free up markets as much as possible and that, you know, we have to send signals and we've got to, you know, I don't know, write in code and we've got to make sure. In other words, the government itself is not an instrument to be used directly in the economy. Everything has to be done through the middle men who run the markets. And to my way of thinking, that's the big fallacy here, is that they actually believe that these same people who just ran a con of unbelievable proportions and are about to do it again. I mean, just, you know, see what these people are doing and look at the markets and, you know, it, this isn't reason that's driving them. It's opportunism. And, they are perfectly willing to kill the golden goose, more willing than ever now that we've shown that we'll bail them out, right, no matter what they do. And so, you know, this kind of, you know, it's the whole confidence fairies thing that, that Paul Krugman talks about and bond vigilantes and this, these phantoms that they've created that are now in their minds instruments of the economy that they can influence and only in an indirect way. What it really is, it's an abdication of their own power, and we can speculate about what the reasons for that might be, but I think a lot of it has to do with campaign contributions and class solidarity and a whole lot of stuff like that. But it's very, very obvious to me that they don't know what to do, or if they do know, they're rejecting those solutions, and
or they have a different measure of success.
True. I mean, and that's possible. True. Yeah, I shouldn't take that off.
I mean, I think that they're, I mean, it is clear that they don't, at the very least, the calculation from the administration is that the worst thing about the massive unemployment and continuing unemployment we have is talking about it.
Yes. Yes.
Not the actual pain on the ground. Right. Not what it's going to do to maybe the future of our workforce. The worst thing about it is that people talk about it. And beyond that, there's no urgency. So let's just not talk about it, and we've dealt with half the problem.
Right. And I think that there's also an idea that, you know, if you talk about it, you depress people, then they won't go out and they won't, you know, spend up their credit cards. And then where will we be? We really need people to be optimistic. So let's not talk about, you know, let's not be Debbie Downers here with all this talk about unemployment.
That's what I got to do for the Majority Report membership. I got to stop talking about unemployment just to get.
Well, you know, I mean, this is an old story. You know, I remember back in the the early 90s during that sort of, you know, what now is a tiny little recession that we were all, right, you know, angst-ridden over at the time. But it that was one of the big things, you know, don't talk the economy down. You got to talk it up, because only that will make everyone believe. I mean, it's all sort of this weird armchair psychology that seems to be driving this, whereas the truth is that the government, they need to spend money. This isn't brain surgery. It's not really a difficult problem. They need to spend a bunch of money and put people to work, put money in their pockets so that they can, you know, pay down their debt and go buy a bunch of stuff and basically, you know, live like human beings and have the economy recover. I mean, it's not, I realize it's not politically easy because we have, you know, batshit insane people in the Congress, worse now than ever. I mean, Michelle Bachmann, I heard this morning, is talking about running for president, and God knows, I hope she does. But, you know,
Dorsey, you know, just gave a fist pump in my office. He just was like, yes. He's already planning all the videos. Let me ask you this, and we got to wrap it up here in just a minute. But what can we do to fight the Social Security the Social Security cuts? I mean, when guys like Dick Durbin are coming out of the room and saying like, I think we can live with raising the retirement age, what can we do?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is tough, but I've got to admit, I think one of the things that you know, there have been people sort of tuned into this for quite some time. You know, people who've been working on it. They've got this group called the Social Security Works, and there are a lot of academics and various think tanks and groups who've been sort of organizing around this because they saw it coming too. It's not like, I mean, like I said, you know, this was Obama called it a grand bargain and put Social Security on the table. So it's not like he's been keeping it a secret. And I think that's one of the things we have to fight. I've been reading a lot recently, even among some liberals, saying, well, I don't know. You know, Obama's never said he's going to cut Social Security. He just wants to fix it. Well, you know, that's what we need to fight. And I think that that's one of the things that is.
So we have to clearly delineate, essentially, where Obama stands on this.
Yes. And I think, look, tax hikes are not going to happen. I think that is a pipe dream. Right. It will not happen in this Congress. It just won't. It is a heavy lift to hike taxes at any point. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton basically blew up his first term on doing a tax hike. And Obama totally whiffed on it. He had a chance to let the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy expire. But he would have had to do it by extending them for the middle class early in his term when he had the political clout to do it, and he didn't. So, you know, they knew they weren't going to extend those. I mean, I think that, you know, they knew they weren't going to let them expire.
Right, right.
I think they just knew that. Otherwise, they would have strategized very differently, because once they were decoupled from the middle class tax cuts, you could have done it. Otherwise, it was always going to be a hostage situation. So, you know, it's a very, very heavy lift to do it. I don't even think they're going to be able to re-raise the taxes, the payroll tax. They're not going to do that. That new agreement that they did with the 2% payroll tax holiday. Ask Gray Davis how that works out. Because he tried to do that in California when California got into trouble in 2003, and he got recalled and kicked out of office for trying to raise a car tax back up to a level that it had been previously.
Right.
And now it's 2003. I mean, I can't even imagine what would happen if they try to do it now. So it won't happen. So tax hikes are off the table. Even the same. You know, lifting the cap. It won't happen. I think that's absolutely insane. So the only way you can, quote, fix Social Security is through benefits cuts. And that's what they're talking about. So, that you know, to me, it's just really simple. We just hammer it home over and over again.
It's
and
not broken.
Be annoying professional and amateur left, you know, whiners, and let people throw their, you know, cast their slings and arrows at us and just take it, because we have to get that out there into the bloodstream that this is what's happening.
So in other words, basically what you're saying is stop hoping for the pony for Christmas and just deal with the shoes that you're getting.
Exactly.
We got to be defensive. We've got to go back into that defensive posture and recognize that's the situation we're in and fight as if this is 2005 all over again.
Exactly. And don't expect, you know, I mean, the White House isn't going to love us for it.
No. Nope.
They're going to hate us for it. So just expect that. Understand that that's our job. That's what we have to do. And stop hoping that we can all, you know, be one big, big, happy family. This is tough. It's not the position that anybody wants to be in. But we didn't ask for it. We didn't put Social Security on the menu. You know, it is what it is. And the people responsible for it are the people responsible for it.
Digby from the blog Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Sam. It was fun as always.
Yes, I enjoyed it. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
All right, folks. We went a little long. Didn't get to all the stuff I wanted to get to. This is going to make my research easier sometime at the end of the week. Maybe I'll have to do another podcast. I will take your IMs at Majority FM, Sam Cedar Show, almost immediately. I mean, practically in about 20 seconds. And, folks, if you enjoy coffee, and I know you do, visit justcoffee.coop. Get your 10% discount by using the coupon code MAJORITY. And speaking of majority, why not become a Majority Report member? Let's fight this battle on Social Security together. Think of the Majority Report as your retirement insurance. You won't be able to eat, but at least you have something to listen to every day. All right, folks, stick around for the post show. We are back. Breaking news, ladies and gentlemen. Dorsey?
Everybody's favorite TV show host and former Air America personality, Montel Williams, busted at the airport for marijuana paraphernalia.
He smokes a lot of pot because of his MS, right?
Correct. MS.
We will update you as more information comes into our newsroom. Had some great, I meant to read some good, really funny tweets. When I posted about the capitulation on the so-called death panels. some very good tweets in response. This is my favorite one, was from Black Taco. Maybe Obama accidentally left his presidency on auto capitulate when he got back from vacation. Malacandra. But Obama had to do it. The GOP was holding infant mortality hostage. It would be interesting to see how far they could get away with that. Like, okay, Senator Graham is on the Senate floor right now with a knife to a baby's neck. If we don't cut taxes for the rich, he's going to have to kill the baby. Literally. Like a literal baby. David Lidsky, is there a battered president shelter that we can check Obama into? So there you have it. Twitter works, ladies and gentlemen. Twitter works. And now to see if IM works. A lot of our IMers have not come back. Where's Svengali says? Timothy Johnson, oh my God, from the makers of Red Dawn for the Xbox 360, Homefront, a game whose premise is a Chinese takeover of the U.S., including death camps and forced labor. Fantastico. Rob Coates, hi, anything interesting released by WikiLeaks recently? Yes, you know, I have a whole packet here of WikiLeaks stuff. That got all screwed up today because of our technical situation with Digby, but I'll get to it. I mean, you know, the thing about this WikiLeaks stuff, it's sort of evergreen. basically because it comes from over the past 20 years. I'm interviewing Glenn Greenwald for Ring of Fire this weekend to talk about sort of almost the meta stories on some level of WikiLeaks, because that's become the biggest story on some level, even bigger, at least in this country, than the actual cable releases themselves, although it probably shouldn't be that way. Optimal Tomatoes, Dick Cheney has no pulse. Where's the death certificate? Still love Tesho, waiting for Zavizini, 73. Became a member of 1221. But I seem to have gotten no emails. Yes, I know. I got to get on. I got to send out an email blast. I got to send out another member's email blast. This weekend is probably when it's going to happen. I blame PayPal also. Can you play the horn drop? I just did it. The shofar. David, no need to... Oh, don't worry about it. Do not worry about it. Don't be a putz. Sorry, I was unclear yesterday. The estate tax. Let's say I have $50 million estate when I die. My wife and I can give $10 million to each of my two children and my two nieces. The remaining $10 million of my estate can now be passed along tax-free. What? I don't think that's correct. Don't be a putz, but I got to check. Can you send me links to what you're talking about? Because I do not believe you're correct. But maybe you are, but I don't know. Rusty Cole, Eric Erickson has just announced he's going to do his own radio show. 50,000 watts. Every day I'm calling into Cantor and Boner's asking office, well, where's the jobs bill? When are they going to do something positive instead of negative things? I hope you're not holding your breath while you do that. Here's Eric Erickson's. I want to do radio. Since I started filling the radio, I have two separate offers from nationally syndicated. I've turned them both down. One does not need to get set behind the EIB golden microphone. I also have a different nationally syndicated show. Frankly, I wouldn't want to do a nationally syndicated show. As long as Rush Limbaugh exists, there is no way I'd ever be number one, no matter how hard I worked. Boy, this is so annoying. What is the show? Oh, WSB Radio in Atlanta. Local show. Well, I don't really care. I don't really care. Matthew, Bachman might run against Amy Kay, in for Minnesota Senators. Scott Brewer. Oh, Scott, thank you for your invitation over the holidays. That was very kind. My trip was rather brief. And traumatic. Net neutrality. If AT wants to control certain internet content via bandwidth restrictions, doesn't this mean they'll also have to accept more legal responsibility for all the internet content they pass through? If they can identify and control Netflix, shouldn't they also identify and block bomb-making instructions, child porn? Well, I see where you're going with this, but they're simply going to say it really is a question of bandwidth, not content.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier to say don't let X amount of bandwidth go through the...
emanate from certain servers rather than, like, don't let these words go through.
Right, right. And then you need to check and see, you know, right, what all those web pages are.
Nice try, though, Scott. Venture 517, missed the first two nights of you hosting Countdown, but the nights I did see, I thought you did a great job. Thought you showed a lot more personality than the other guys. Subkeys, personalities, is what makes the show stand out, so I think you have nailed it. I'm not usually at a computer during the day, otherwise I would have said this sooner. Well, Venture, I appreciate it. It's very kind. You can always email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We check that quite frequently. Watched the last five episodes of Caprica yet? It's good, but it felt rushed. Wait. Wait. Where are they available? Are they available on iTunes? Are there five, or are there two, or three, or what? The last Caprica episode I watched was, let's see. On sci-fi.com, streaming. What? I paid good money for iTunes. Bastards. The last one I guess I watched was False Labor or Things We Lock Away. They had a marathon last night. Why are you telling me this today? Right. Great. Well, whatever. It'll show up on iTunes eventually. Oops. Thank you, Harold. That's very sweet of you. Sadly, not paying into retirement is exactly why the state of Illinois is in trouble. For at least a decade, both parties had voted to spend the employer contribution portion of state worker retirement funds on public works. State workers are not eligible for Social Security because they have this alternative retirement plan. However, it is billions of dollars behind. Now they want to kill the pensions that thousands depend on. I think this is the plan they implement for Social Security. Hollow it out and allow it to collapse. Exactly. That's exactly why they cut back on the Social Security tax. Exactly. Jay Schiavo. Gibbs to leave his White House press secretary. Does your daughter now have bangs like Yolandi? Who's Yolandi? I knew about Gibbs. Happy to see him go.
You are a douchebag.
Klug, what about Gibbs leaving?
You are a douchebag.
I think Gibbs was sort of a douchebag. His independent expenditure campaign, is he going counterattack outlet? I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm sure he'll do some, he'll be a net positive, but he's not the guy I wanted as a spokesman. I mean, I think he just was a very anti-liberal voice in the administration, is my sense. Sam, assuming you're able to vote in a blue state like New York that will almost certainly vote for Obama for president by a wide margin next election, no matter what happens, would you consider voting third party next election? Do you see any value in that? I always vote working family parties fusion ticket. Now, to be honest, I can't remember if Obama was on that ticket last time, but that's the way I vote. And it's fusion voting. So you vote for the same. I mean, yeah, I suppose I could vote, you know, for a third party, but. You know, I would have to see who it was, and I just don't think, you know, I just don't think that third party, particularly on a national level, is anywhere close to being viable. And I vote fusion. Mark Green says, you are always right, Mark. Jimmy Reed for Cake, welcome back. Bad to hear about Montel. I hear Willie Nelson got busted in Texas a few weeks ago. I have to say that in a country where beneficial and medicinal plant is outlawed for political reasons, the chances of tackling other more complex economic issues that you rant about are near zero. Priorities. Let the reefer madness domino effect begin.
Just to let him know, everything's okay. It was just a citation.
It's just a citation.
He's a millionaire.
I don't. It's okay. You know, look. I don't think the legalization of pot is going to create a domino effect in dealing with other issues. Let's say, for instance, Social Security. I just don't think that's going to happen. I don't see the argument there. Do I agree with you that pot should be decriminalized? Yes. Do I think that the war on drugs is a horrible waste of money and backfires on us? Yes. Was I disappointed to see the referendum in California fail? Yes. Jimmy Reef for Cake. Montel is rich, but what about the kids in the city getting slammed? I agree. Agree.
I'm just saying, don't worry about Montel. He'll be okay.
Would you support Alan Grayson for president in 2012, even to pull Obama's platform to the left? I'd contemplate it. I don't know. I'd contemplate it. You know, like I've said in the past, that right now my feeling is that a liberal challenge to Obama would be good in that, well, let me put it this way. I should describe a scenario rather than say this is the scenario that I would want to see. I don't know if I would want to see this. But a liberal challenge to Obama would increase the likelihood that Bloomberg would get into the race. And I think there are other factors that would also have to draw Bloomberg into the race, like Palin essentially becoming the nominee. He has the ability to jump in late. That's the advantage he has. He can literally jump in April or March of 2012. He could jump in probably in April or May and just land with as much money. The only problem is he won't have the infrastructure that Obama has or that that Palin has. But who knows? But you know, here's the problem. You can pull Obama's platform to the left, and then what? Doesn't mean he's going to do it. But it might help us on in the Senate. If he goes to the left, it might help us with the Senate. Because it would, you know, activate the base more. I don't know. I have some thinking to do on all that. Kevin semicolon. Alan Grayson would have to get some better neckties. Agreed. Taurusy 80. We shouldn't be surprised that no one is listening to Glenn Beck in New York, Boston, and Philly because the three are the most anti-right-wing cities in the country. Well, true, but, I mean, Limbaugh and Hannity, I mean, WABC is the biggest station in New York by far. And it is extremely right-wing. Pterodactyl, you can't send me big messages like that because they're too big and it won't go through. You approach the third-party issue as if the only useful outcome is victory. After Obama's miserable first term, I'd rather have a Republican office, leaving Democratic strategists to count the third-party vote tallies. Well, I mean, well, if you want a Republican in office, would you want Palin in office? I mean, like I say, the third party issue, you know, I would see some value maybe, depending on what Obama does, in a Bloomberg candidacy, because I think with Bloomberg you're going to get the same policies as you're getting with Obama, but you won't, you know, sort of ruin the Democratic Party as a potential vehicle for more progressive change in the future. So, but would I trade Sarah Palin for Obama? No. We've seen what happens when you get Sarah Palin in there. Her name was George Bush. Though I guess he was a little more blue blood. Like the Digby, Andrew, you should have Atreus on as well. Thanks for playing the drop. Yes, I have Atreus on. We're gonna get back into a regular schedule with guests. It's just everybody's having trouble with the. You get back into work and. Under Obama tax deal, 2011 could be the best year ever for the rich. Don't be a putt. Send me that to majorityreporters@gmail.com. Thank you. Scott Brewer, legalizing pot here and in Mexico would sure help calm things down along the border areas. Absolutely. Mexico is just a disaster. Yeah, it should show on iTunes, especially if you got the whole season. I bit tore into 2 weeks ago. Oh. That Montel thing was messed up. It was in Milwaukee. I personally bought brand new water pipes through JFK from the Netherlands without an eyebrow raised. Well, if it's unused, it's unused. I mean, how about the idea of an independent expected counterattack outlet? Uncoordinated, of course. Jeb Romney, Huckabee, or Bloomberg in New York? Shaping up to be Huckabee versus Romney in Oregon.
Did you see that thing on Daily Coast today about Daschle's son?
No.
He was, I guess he was in charge of electing governors or getting governors elected and failed miserably. And it was about nepotism. That was the whole point of the post. But he's starting some kind of third-party consulting firm out of Washington. It's like a media consulting, like helping them get their message out over the internet and all this kind of stuff. It's called Ruckus. And... it's like
no labels.
Like, yeah, exactly. Not third party, like
no competency.
Yes.
Cool. J146 says there's value in voting against a Democrat in a blue state. I agree, but you got to. There is value, but it depends on who you vote for, you know, whether or not you can be written off and how you do it, I think. But, you know, the specifics are very important. Mark Green says, just wanted to hear you say, That's why he wrote, you are always right, Mark. And then he writes, thanks, just wanted to hear you say it. How about once more is Fenton? Mark! Somebody sent me an email saying, I love Fenton. Can you send me an autographed picture? How about you send me a picture and I'll send you an autograph? Just get walk around with like headshots of an animated character in a show I did 5 years ago. I don't even know what the character looks like because I never watched cartoons. I got a hilarious email yesterday that I'm going to read. It was like a... it was from a friend of mine who was a writer on, on Bob's Burgers. I can't find it now. And she was sending out a group, here it is, email, okay, of which I'm on because I'm a friend of hers. Hello, friends. I'm excited to tell you the show I've been writing on this year, Bob's Burgers, premiering on Fox this Sunday, January 9th at 8:30 p.m. The show was created by Lauren Bouchard of Dr. Katz Home Movies, Lucy, Daughter of the Devil. It stars the voices of John Benjamin, John Roberts, Christian Schaal, Eugene Merman, and Dan Mintz. We also have had amazing guest voices this season, including Larry Murphy, Andy Kindler, Sarah Silverman, Laura Silverman, Todd Barry, John Glazier, Paul F. Tompkins, and Kevin Klein. Please watch it if you like, and feel free to tell your friends, relatives, and gardeners, taxi cabs, your cats, anyone else you might speak to. Thanks, and Happy New Year. Notice something missing about that? I think Larry Murphy was the only guest voice that was on more shows than me. Because he is a really shockingly talented voice artist. I can do like one or two voices that sound almost identical. He was Assie McGee, Larry Murphy, but my name's not on the list. And so I wrote her back and asked the email. I said, "Dear friend," and it's like, "What did I write?" Hi, friend. You know, Holly, this is the third most awkward email I've received today, And I am familiar with Bob's Burgers and appreciate the heads up. Actually, I think I appear in 1 to 7 or 8 episodes. Though I guess I am not an amazing guest voice. I'm fine with being considered a competent guest voice or maybe just an inexpensive guest voice. However, my cats are extreme Sam Cedar voice work fans, and frankly, they'd be pretty upset if I were to show them this email. In fact, I rarely take a cab in which the driver doesn't say something like, "Keep talking. You have an amazing voice, and you are my guest. Please advise on how I should proceed." She called me literally like 30 seconds after I sent that email. So sorry. I don't. Let's see. Torsi 80. Shouldn't be surprised. Okay. Was it on purpose that the graphic on the top of the right of majority part says podcast via web? Wes Byte?
Does it still say that?
Well, who's going to change it, Dorsey? You made the banner. What do you mean, does it still say that? That's the banner you made. It's not going to change unless you change the banner.
I thought somebody never mind.
Who? Who? Says that on that banner, on the Sam Cedar Show site where I have it, on all the emails I send out, on our YouTube page.
This means we need to change the banner.
Yeah, and by we, you approach the third, okay, I think the Power Gets Done is organized citizens groups. The Palin presidency would help that more than a second term for Obama. Right, just like how that happened with Bush. It worked out so well by having Bush. It really congealed the left.
I felt congealed.
Do I need to put on some music that indicates I'm being sarcastic? I just don't... I just don't subscribe to that notion that having Palin would be somehow better for the country in the long run. I just don't subscribe to that. I don't think she can win, which I think is a good thing, but I don't think having Thune is better, or Huckabee, or Romney. Don't. You got to show me something other than sort of your gut feeling that the American people will rise up. Because I didn't see it during Bush. I saw the Democrats take control of the House in 2006, partly because the Republican Party had literally turned into the party of criminals and pedophiles. Literally. You know, they say, like, the only way Obama's going to lose election is they find him with a dead girl or a live boy. Right? I mean, or that's the saying, not even Obama, but just in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they actually found that with the Republican Congress. Sammy Cameron used to believe that the two parties simply had different opinions about how to achieve what is best for America. Now I'm convinced it's all about party and power, and we the people don't enter the equation at all. Well, I don't think the Democratic Party is all about party, frankly, because they certainly aren't helping themselves in any fashion whatsoever. I think it's less about party than it is about money, corporate influence, which I think is transpartisan, or I shouldn't even say transpartisan because I don't even – they're transpartisan. At this point. Morella, I think you should get a do a video compilation of your could have been somebody segments and peddle it for swag. Fair enough. I love the little segment where you're doing a spoof of sign language. Don't remember the details. Was it for Saturday Night Live? No, it was for Spin City. Perillo. Dr. Kathy says at least Romney could benefit the sixth brother. Touche! You're going to get one of these for I tried to find the website the other day. I couldn't even find it.
You showed it to me a while ago.
Yeah, I can't remember where it is. Oh, that's what it is. Sixth brother, not sixth son. That's why I couldn't find it. I've got to find those original videos. Hi, Sam. Happy New Year. I agree with you, Reap Hale. And she wins. Country moves further right. Things go to shit a la Bush. Dems get back in power. Screwed up. Country moves further right. Repeat. Yes. Oh, and you know what? Matthew has exactly the point. And I it's so pathetic I even forgot to say this. Supreme Court. One more Republican nominee. Now, granted, every single person appointed to the court in the past, I think, 50 years has moved the court to the right in terms of who they've replaced. Every single one. Ginsburg, Breyer, all of them. Sotomayor. All of them. But the next one is going to make the court basically lock it up till, you know. I'm not doing the majority report because the lack of teeth is making a whistle when I talk. You're going to get more Citizens United. It may be that we've just simply sort of crossed the Rubicon. Is that it? The Maginot line. The whatever it is. The looking glass. And it's done there. Or maybe, you know, God forbid something happens to a member of the Supreme Court. Like he puts one too many pubes on a Coke can and makes an issue of it. And his wife gets really pissed off. Starts demanding apologies from Coke. You know? Sixbrother.blogspot. Thank you, Dr. Kathy. All right, folks. See you tomorrow. Music outro, please.
You know, it comes in so fast sometimes. So we're talking.
Evan's just sitting there just going like, oh, well, I guess I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah, oh, wait a second. I'm supposed to play.
Yeah, that's me.
See you tomorrow, folks.
To get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. Between the truth and the light bulb. Feel any better. Yeah, I know.